You're going to love this. Just love it.
Pacifica Radio, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. In Oregon, KYAQ, Central Coast, KSO, Cottage Grove, KEPW, Eugene. Lancaster, Pennsylvania's WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii, on KAKU. Columbus, Ohio, WGRN. Palinville, New York, WLPP. Grand Rapids, Michigan, WPRR. New Orleans, WHIV. Gallup, New Mexico, KNIZ. In Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas, KPSQ. Seattle, Washington, KODX. Red Bluff, Redding, California, KFOI. Round Mountain, California, KKRN. Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950, KTNF. And coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing the globe 5 days a week, as usually hosted by Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. But you have me, Angie Coiro, today. I host In Deep with Angie Coiro, heard on many of these fine stations and streams. Man, I've been trying to get this show together for you all day, and the news just keeps flying in. Aside from his predictable impotent rage at Robert Mueller on Twitter, Donald Trump is making actual changes in powerful chairs, doing all this on a Friday, one after another after another. So here's the scoop so far, the count on that, some alleged, some confirmed. Stand by for all the details. The head of the Army will move over to chair the Joint Chiefs of Staff. William Barr is up for confirmation as the next Attorney General. Fox talking head Heather Nauer is up to replace Nikki Haley as U.S. UN Ambassador. So let us take them in that order. The Washington Post bulletin, the first story, here are their details. President Trump is expected to choose the head of the Army to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, tapping a voluble and unconventional combat veteran to become America's top military officer. This from individuals familiar with White House plans to the paper. The president plans to announce his nomination of General Mark Milley at Saturday's annual Army-Navy football game. This ends months of speculation about who will replace the current chairman, Joseph F. Dunford Jr., who is set to step down next fall. So here's where a little White House intrigue comes in. According to individuals who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss a decision, that has not been made public, Trump considered two senior officers, Milley and Air Force Chief of Staff General David Goldfein, whom Defense Secretary Jim Mattis preferred. It is not clear why Mattis preferred Goldfein, another widely respected cerebral officer. Well, cerebral probably knocked him out of the park right there. Can't be putting cerebral people in the White House or anywhere near it. Some current and former officials, we're back on the Post now, some current and former officials cited the president's decision to go with Milley as a sign of the Pentagon chief's diminished influence with the White House. That's what happens to cerebral people these days. It is a big decision to go against Mattis, said one former top defense official who spoke again to the Post on the condition of anonymity. Now, here's something to note. Trump's pick is getting ready for action against North Korea, although not with any enthusiasm. The Post has this as well. Quote, Milley dedicated time to making sure the U.S. military understood the risks and was prepared for a possible conflict with North Korea. Inside the Pentagon, he warned that any conflict would lead to massive loss of life and catastrophic damage. I can't talk today. Catastrophic damage. At the same time, he pushed the Pentagon to rethink how such a war might be fought and to improve the readiness of the entire joint force to carry out an attack on North Korea if ordered. This according to a senior Army official. And another worthy tidbit from the very end of that piece. Milley's willingness to speak out has occasionally appeared to put him at odds with his commander-in-chief after Trump was criticized for appearing to condone some of the white nationalist protesters in Charlottesville. Milley tweeted that the Army, quote, doesn't tolerate racism, extremism, or hatred in our ranks, seemingly distancing himself from Trump's comments. And, quote, you'd think that'd be a disqualifier right there, huh? Okay, that's chair number one in the round robin today. Now, the man in line for the U.S. Attorney General chair is not Matthew Whitaker. It is instead a fellow who thinks it's more important and more legit to investigate Hillary Clinton than Russian election interference. Again, gotta know why this guy is qualified, huh? New York Times reports William Barr is headed back to the chair he occupied for George Bush the First. From its coverage, quote, parts of his record are likely to be closely scrutinized by Democrats. No kidding. Mr. Barr has criticized aspects of the Russia investigation, including suggesting that Robert Mueller hired many prosecutors who had donated to Democratic campaigns. He also has defended Trump's call for a new criminal investigation into his 2016 opponent, Hillary Clinton, because that matters more than anything else, including over a uranium mining deal the Obama administration approved when she was Secretary of State. Mr. Barr told the New York Times last year there's nothing inherently wrong about a president calling for an investigation, although an investigation shouldn't be launched just because a president wants it. Yeah. The ultimate question is whether the matter warrants investigation, end quote, which Russia apparently doesn't, my quote. Mr. Barr added that then he saw more basis for investigating the uranium deal than any supposed conspiracy between Mr. Trump's associates and Russia. To the extent it is not pursuing these matters, the department is abdicating its responsibility, he said. Now, the Times spoke to Norm Eisen, who served as special counsel for ethics and government overhaul under President Barack Obama, and here's his text response to them. Mr. Barr has a general mainstream GOP and corporate reputation. He's put forward the discredited idea that Hillary Clinton's role in the Uranium One deal is more worthy of investigation than collusion between Trump and Russia. His text continued, that is bizarre. And he was involved in the dubious George H.W. Bush end-of-term pardons that may be a precedent for even more illegitimate ones by Trump. Senator Richard Blumenthal is promising the Democrats would carefully vet him. Especially, he said, in light of past comments suggesting Mr. Barr was more interested in currying favor with Trump than objectively and thoughtfully analyzing law and facts. In reference to those pardons, here's the ominous note from Zach Dorfman of foreignpolicy.com. He notes via Twitter, Bill Barr, Trump's new AG pick, literally oversaw, as AG, George H.W. Bush's slew of pardons for the Iran-Contra scandal, including a pardon of former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, before his trial even began. He finishes that tweet with, the light is flashing red, folks. Well, this is timely. Even as I was bringing you this, here's a new bulletin from the Washington Post. James Fields Jr., who drove his car into that crowd in Charlottesville and killed Heather Heyer, he has been found guilty of first-degree murder. Just in. Found guilty of first-degree murder in the car ramming the killed, one and wounded, dozens, a win. One in the win column. A little bit of justice there. Okay, so let us move on to a People for the American Way statement on this appointment of Bill Barr. Committing to the rule of law includes allowing special counsel Robert Mueller to complete his investigation without interference, including from the White House. The next attorney general must turn the page on the extreme attacks on civil rights that persisted throughout Jeff Sessions' tenure into the office. Now, here's an interesting twist. This is from Chris Geidner at BuzzFeed. The paperwork on Jeff Sessions' departure was never filed. And that's not just trivia. Here's the scoop that he had at BuzzFeed. The Justice Department hasn't told the Government Accountability Office that Jeff Sessions quit. Under the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, the head of the Justice Department was supposed to report the vacancy and any appointment of an acting attorney general to the head of the Government Accountability Office immediately. It has been a month since Trump forced Sessions to resign from his position as attorney general and then tweeted that Matthew Whitaker, Sessions' chief of staff, would be the acting attorney general. There's been no notification. This reporting is important, he explains, in addition to being the law, which is irrelevant to Trump, because the GAO tracks the length of service of acting officers under the vacancies law and is responsible for reporting to Congress and the White House when such acting officers serve beyond the permitted time allowed under the law. Neither the White House nor the Justice Department has been willing to make the presidential memorandum appointing Whitaker, so the lack of notification is a further irregularity that makes the process behind Trump's decision to appoint Whitaker less transparent and less easily understood. Thanks to Chris Geidner for that scoop. Continuing his tradition of hiring the least qualified and most partial, Trump has named Fox alum Heather Nauert as Nikki Haley's successor as UN ambassador. What makes her right for the post? Bloomberg says not a whole lot. Quote, she's an unusual choice for the UN role, given that she had little experience in government or foreign policy before joining the administration in April 2017, after several years as an anchor and correspondent and blonde for Fox News. Yes, I stuck that in there, including on Fox and Friends, watched by Trump. Haley also lacked foreign policy experience when she took the UN posting, but she had twice been elected governor of South Carolina, as opposed to just being a news anchor and talking blonde head. Nevertheless, Nauert's candidacy had the strong support of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who came to trust her as a reliable voice and advocate for Trump's agenda. Is that all? No. It was a stark turnaround from the era of Pompeo's predecessor, Rex Tillerson, who shut her out from his inner circle. She had threatened to quit several times under Tillerson, but thanks partially to her alliance with Trump's daughter, Ivanka, and her husband, Jared Kushner, she ended up outlasting her former boss. Again, that is from Bloomberg. Wait, there's more. The shuffle is apparently not over. The New York Times says that John Kelly is on his way out the door. Well, they say it again. Quote, in another personnel move, John F. Kelly, the White House chief of staff, is expected to leave his post in the next few days, ending a tumultuous 16-month tenure, still among the longest for a senior aide to Mr. Trump. Two people with direct knowledge of the developments said on Friday. Mr. Kelly and Mr. Trump have grown weary of each other, but Mr. Trump, according to several senior admin officials and people close to him, can you imagine being close to Trump? Yikes. Has so far been unable to bring himself to personally fire a retired four-star military general. It's unclear who the replacement for Mr. Kelly would be. Nick Ayers, the VP's chief of staff, is seen as a leading candidate. Oh, looky here. He's supported by Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Well, that's getting around, doesn't it? CNN notes that, Kelly has been talking to Mueller's people. They report White House Chief of Staff John Kelly was interviewed by Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team in recent months. Three people with knowledge of the matter told CNN. Kelly responded to a narrow set of questions from Special Counsel investigators after White House lawyers initially objected to Mueller's request. Kelly is widely expected to leave his position, as just noted, and is no longer on speaking terms with Trump. Kelly is the latest high-ranking White House official known to provide information for Mueller's investigation. No wonder Donnie stopped talking to him. You know who's doing some really fantastic minute-by-minute coverage of the Mueller investigation and its fallout, along with lightning-fast news loads like today? The Guardian UK, they've got a running tally. If you look at its timeline today, it's pretty dazzling. Here are some highlights. Former FBI Director James Comey is testifying on Capitol Hill before the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees. The closed-door hearing will touch on both Russia and Comey's handling of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server as the Secretary of State. Comey at first resisted testifying in private, but he agreed after a deal was reached to release a transcript of the interview. This, too, from The Guardian, George Papadopoulos, the former foreign policy aide to Donald Trump's presidential campaign, was released from prison on Friday after serving 12 days for lying to the feds about his contacts with the Russians. He was the first Trump associate to cooperate with special counsel Mueller and pleaded guilty to perjury last year. The FBI launched the Russia investigation after Papadopoulos bragged to Australia, to their then ambassador to the UK, that Moscow had dirt on Hillary Clinton. He will now undergo 12 months of supervised release. He's required to serve 200 hours of community service within about a year, in addition to paying a $9,500 fine. And one more from The Guardian before we move along. Tucker Carlson, of all people, has given up on Trump. He was talking to Die Weltwoche in Switzerland, and he said his chief promises were that he would build the wall, defund Planned Parenthood, and repeal Obamacare. He hasn't done any of those things. I've come to believe Trump's role is not as a conventional president who promises to get certain things achieved with Congress and then does. Not only has Trump failed to come through, Carlson said, he might not even be able to. I don't think he's capable, Carlson went on, both due to his own shortcomings and his inability to muster legislators to follow his lead. I don't think he's capable of sustained focus. I don't think he understands the system. I don't think Congress is on his side. I don't think even his own agencies support him. So you know what's going to happen at this point. Carlson will just be tossed into the bucket of fake news. He will join the parade of former beloveds who are now decried as part of fake news media. Trump's followers are benumbed. They are completely inoculated against any judgment but his. And that, my friends, continues to be the biggest battle when trying to impart any contrary facts at all. More to come on this dazzlingly busy news day. This is The Bradcast. I'm Angie Coiro. It's The Bradcast. I'm Angie Coiro, in for Brad and Des today. Coming up not too long from now, my conversation with Lara Bazelon. You know, we hear those stories that come out occasionally about the innocent guy cleared by DNA, and then that's kind of all we hear. Well, she's looking into restorative justice programs that try to give them at least some part of their lives back, some kind of recompense, and in fact, sometimes direct interaction with their accusers, who, as it turns out, are suffering nearly as much. There's a lot of suffering for the accusers who realize that they probably put somebody away for decades. Not an easy burden. That's coming up in a few minutes here on The Bradcast. Another news alert just winging its way through the ether. Federal prosecutors in Manhattan have stepped over Robert Mueller's recommendation that Michael Cohen serve no time incarcerated. Mueller made that recommendation on the case that he is trying. By contrast, New York federal prosecutors in their separate case have asked a judge to give Trump's former lawyer about 4 years in prison. The Washington Post pulled out this quote from the prosecutor's sentencing memo, quote, he seeks extraordinary leniency, a sentence of no jail time, based principally on his rose-colored view of the seriousness of the crimes, his claims to a sympathetic personal history, his provision of certain information to law enforcement, prosecutors wrote in their filing, but the crimes committed by Cohen were more serious than his submission allows and were marked by a pattern of deception that permeated his professional life. Now, the judge in that case is going to take that into consideration, of course, along with Cohen's attorneys who asked for no time. He'll roll all that into a ball and come out with some kind of judgment. Hey, we're going back to Trump's mostly impotent rage tweeting. If you're wondering why he went on a 280-character record deriding Rex Tillerson as, quote, dumb as a rock and, quote, lazy as hell, a guy he, quote, couldn't get rid of fast enough, it's because Tillerson went public with sentiments that were insufficiently worshipful. Tillerson was interviewed Thursday by CBS veteran Bob Schaefer at a public event. The Houston Chronicle has lots of juicy bits, as does CBS. Tillerson said flat out Russia did interfere with the election, and he paints Vladimir Putin as much smarter than Trump. That was the duh point of the evening, apparently, in case you haven't figured that one out yet. But it's nice to hear Tillerson's vote on that as well. Now, Tillerson says Putin plays three-dimensional chess while he painted Trump as, all right, here's the money quote. "It's challenging for me, coming from the disciplined, highly process-oriented ExxonMobil Corporation, to go to work for a man who is pretty undisciplined. Doesn't like to read. Doesn't read briefing reports. Doesn't like to get into the details of a lot of things. But rather than just kind of say, look, this is, oh, let me scratch that. But rather just kind of says, look, this is what I believe, and you can try to convince me otherwise, but most of the time you're not going to do that. Yow. Back to his quote, so often the president would say, here's what I want to do, and here's how I want to do it, and I would have to say to him, Mr. President, I understand what you want to do, but you can't do it that way. It violates the law, Tillerson said. Trump would get very frustrated when they would have these conversations, he said. So, of course, the toddler-in-chief had to hold his breath until his face turned blue while he stamped his little tweety feet. Kind of a segue here. Now that we live online, so many people and companies and organizations post both entrenched points of view and transient thoughts. Maybe you have pondered holding people responsible for opinions expressed long ago. That came up again in this week. Stand-up comic Kevin Hart will not host the Oscars because of the resurrection of harmful, ugly, anti-gay sentiments that he's posted and stated out loud in the past. Out of a handful of tweets, the one commented on most widely was this one. Yo, if my son comes home and tries to play with my daughter's dollhouse, I'm going to break it over his head and say, in my voice, stop, that's gay. Now, his stand-up patter that really stuck to the wall was, quote, me being a heterosexual male, if I can prevent my son from being gay, I will. So he was called on this in numerous venues, and he first said, in essence, okay, that's old news, I've matured. But then he said, I've made the choice to step down from hosting this year's Oscars. This is because I don't want to be a distraction on a night that should be celebrated by so many amazing, talented artists. I sincerely apologize to the LGBTQ community for my insensitive words from my past. I'm sorry that I hurt people. I am evolving and want to continue to do so. My goal is to bring people together, not tear us apart. Let's take a moment to appreciate that is a quality apology. That's not an I'm sorry if. He takes responsibility, admits that he has done actual damage. He reflects on what he needs to do to move on. So kudos to him for that. But to the larger question, this one is not a hill to die on when it comes to trial by Twitter. As bad as that often is, it does raise the issue, however, of how the Academy could possibly screw up their responsibility to perform due diligence before naming this year's signature voice. This should never have happened. This was all public record. Why'd they do that? Let's go to the international front. Angela Merkel stays in the chancellor's seat in Germany while she steps aside as head of the Christian Democratic Union for Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer. That is notable on a couple fronts. One powerful woman handing off power to another, something we still don't see often enough in politics. Second, that lines up Kramp-Karrenbauer as the one to beat when Merkel leaves the chancellorship. Christian Democratic Union is the largest party in the country. And the BBC has gone in depth on the Huawei scandal following the arrest of the company's CFO in Canada December 1st. Now, its article notes the countries that have taken or considered steps detaching from that company's products. It also gives this rundown on why Huawei is seen as problematic. Now, let me note first, there's a lot of some say going on in this piece, but it is a summary piece. That's its point, and it does cover some important basic bits. So here's the gist of it. There are fears that China is using Huawei as a proxy so it can spy on rival nations and scoop up useful information. Huawei says it is independent and gives nothing to the country's government apart from relevant taxes. Critics are questioning how free any major Chinese business can be from Beijing's influence. They point out the Mediaschai founder of the company was a former engineer in the country's army, joined the Communist Party in 1978. Huawei can lay claim to being one of the biggest spenders on research and development and invested more than $13 billion in 2017 and said the figure will be higher in 2018. But critics fear the government could order the firm to modify its devices to help hack attacks, eavesdrop on conversations, or gain high-level access to sensitive networks. Huawei is now the second biggest smartphone maker in the world. That's from the BBC. Now, again, there's not a whole lot on who's specifically making those accusations or holding those concerns, but that is detailed in their other articles, and it's consistent with what I've seen elsewhere. And so in that, it's a valuable roundup. If you don't have the background on this, it's a good place to go to get that substance of what's happening there. Meanwhile, a court in British Columbia was busy with this case today, told that Meng Huangshu is a flight risk. The U.S. is still pursuing her extradition so she can address charges here, that the company was doing business with Iran under another company name, which is a big no-no. Let's get a labor front update, huh? San Francisco had a victorious hotel strike. Why do you care if you're not here? Well, because it's kind of instructive for other union movements everywhere. And the key lesson here is the hardest one. You stick it out. Members of Unite Here, which is the hotel workers union, have been picketing outside Marriott chain hotels, including in world-famous Union Square, since the beginning of October. 2 months out there. And in case you missed the news, we had rain, we had heat, we had pollution levels that were off the charts. Now, I saw them protesting last week and, of course, honked my horn at them. They had their picket signs wrapped in plastic against a downpour. And when the smoke from the NorCal fires was so thick, they were wearing face masks and staying out there. And I really love their slogan, because they were demanding a humane workload and better hours. Their slogan was, "One job should be enough." That is downright radical these days. So another strike is brewing, this one across the ocean. Virgin Atlantic pilots will strike over Christmas. Now, Virgin is saying there will be no disruption to the flight schedule, but what they're doing is they're adhering strictly to the contract. There's no more goodwill extra hours. There's no more, sure, I'll go the extra mile for you. The pilots are just going to do what's in the contract period. Now, in this case, the battle has to do with getting union recognition to begin with. This is the Professional Pilots Union. Represents about a third of the pilots of the airline. According to some sources, the Professional Pilots Union has that number as close to 80%. Don't know what the discrepancy is there. But PPU said it was excluded from talks over proposed changes to pilot benefits. A spokesman said it was the last straw when the union was left out of negotiations after Virgin, quote, consistently refused to recognize the PPU as a legitimate and independent union. Now, a big difference here between the victory in San Francisco and the ongoing dispute in Britain, this is a turf war between two unions, the PPU and BALPA. BALPA was the established union. And this is all the more reason for us, as union members and potential union members, stand up and be counted at your workplace. Make your voice heard to your company, to get a union, and then to your union. Make your voice heard. The choices get made by the people who show up. That's how labor works. Let us talk about the first George Bush, shall we? The pomp and the circumstance and the praise and the music and the tears are kind of fading away. So a little fuller picture is being allowed in public discourse after, of course, being shouted down in the immediate wake of his death. His record with AIDS, for example, with civil rights. His backing of his SCOTUS nominee, Clarence Thomas. His grabbing a handful of women's posteriors at will. Doesn't that sound familiar? Huh, that didn't show up in the eulogies. There's a good roundup of these charming bits of his true history at USA Today. Now, it has links to all of the more detailed stories on all of the assertions above. USA Today also rounded up opinions on why we dive away from a full, honest picture in the eulogies of the president. You know how this works. Somebody big dies. Someone points out something true and honest and not flattering about that person's history, and I say, please, please, observe a respectful silence. Michelle Nickerson, associate professor of history at Loyola University of Chicago, who specializes in women and gender and U.S. politics, says memorializations happen with every president. She says The purpose in this case is to recognize ourselves as a nation. It's almost like we keep quiet about the mistakes of the dead because we want to focus on the things we appreciate and we value and the things we want to honor. There are going to be things that we recall and we choose to forget because we're honoring not just Bush, but the presidency as an institution. Maybe that's why I felt such a disconnect from all the pomp and circumstance. I mean, I'd hear it on the radio, I'd turn it off. I saw it in print, I skimmed it. You know, I really didn't care. And part of me was a little bit puzzled as to why anybody else cared. And now I realize in reading what Nickerson has to say, there's some resonance there. I guess I just don't see the presidency as an institution to honor anymore. It's been peed all over. It's been scratched into the dirt. I don't particularly honor that institution anymore. And maybe that's why I didn't care. I did care that the picture of everything he did before he died was being cleaned up so meticulously. USA Today talked to Yale University history professor Joanne Freeman, and she says these remembrances and presidential legacies are shaped by current political climates. Well, there you go. In this case, she says the need for a retort to the increasingly caustic political landscape has been palpable in our eulogizing. It feels to me like a very emotionally needy moment that's making use of Bush's reputation to serve a purpose. It's become a mourning for decency moment that really isn't about Bush at all. Well, it couldn't be, could it? What kind of decent man would not look at the AIDS crisis and recognize it as a health crisis and give it funding and give its patients and its victims some decency and respect? Why mourn a decent moment for a guy who grabbed women by the tush? Yeah, he apologized. So what? He did it. I mean, I could go on. I know you've heard it. You've probably heard it from Brad. I'm sure you've probably heard it from a number of sources. But, it, you know, it strikes me a bit of honesty here could be an ultimately healthy thing. And like I said, this article uses pointers to go to more detailed areas where you can look up whole bits of what it's asserting. And one of those, I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but I want to give you a taste of it. They point to Issa Leshko's tweet thread, beginning with, "Many members of the LGBT community, people of color, and women have a hard time praising Bush's memory today. Our opposition to his legacy isn't simply a matter of political differences. For many, it was a matter of life and death. A number of people on both sides of the aisle have rushed to praise his grace and honor and remarked upon his wish for a kinder, gentler America. This nostalgia for the Bush era is no different from nostalgia for the 50s. If you're able to think of these periods in history as kinder and gentler, you most likely benefit from privilege relating to your skin color, gender, and sexuality. Let's take as an example," she says, "Bush's gross mishandling of the AIDS crisis. Admittedly, he dealt with it better than Reagan. That is not saying much. He was Reagan's VP during the critical early days of the crisis when the government cruelly ignored what was happening." She goes on to some of her personal experience. Then she goes into Bush's racist history. This is all very well documented, very well put out there, and much too long to read on the air. But if you're a tweeter, go to Issa Leshko, that's I-S-A Leshko, just like it sounds, and check out that thread on George Bush. And for those of you who were around at the time, when it seemed every day you woke up, someone else had died, and no one in the White House would take it seriously, no one in the White House would really address the way these people were being pilloried and treated as monsters instead of victims of a plague. If you're old enough to remember that, if you're old enough to have experienced that, as I did, that would explain the bile in your mouth when you heard and saw all of this praise for the man just buried. Coming up on the broadcast, the story does not end for wrongly convicted when DNA or just plain stubborn court work gets them out of prison. Lara Bazelon picks up the story from there. Stay tuned for that. I'm Angie Coiro. This is the broadcast. It It is the Bradcast. I'm Angie Cuero in for Brad and Des today. As a lawyer, Lara Bazelon worked to free a man wrongly convicted of murder who spent 34 years behind bars. Her work with an L.A. Innocence Project has freed even more. Putting on her journalist hat, she wrote a slew of stories over the years on the same subject for Slate.com and other outlets. Now, she has a book out. It's called Rectify: The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. I talked to her for my show In Deep about how one even begins to make this right. Now, these are excerpts from that conversation.
The case that you defended, let's talk first about, he's got a very peculiar name. His name is Cash Register. How did he end up in his situation?
Cash was accused of robbing and shooting and killing an elderly man named Jack Sasson when Jack Sasson was getting into his car one morning in western Los Angeles. He found himself in that situation because the police fixated on him, and to this day, we're not exactly sure why. Although I do think that it is one of those situations where when you have a name like that, no one ever forgets you. And that's true for better and it's true for worse in Cash's case. He had a couple of very minor juvenile crimes. I think stealing tire rims off a car and maybe some very inexpensive jewelry. And so he was in their system. But it was never quite clear to us why they were so fixated on him.
How did you get onto his story?
So this is truly just an amazing series of twists and turns. At that time, I was the director of the Loyola Law School Project for the Innocent at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Cash had been incarcerated for 3.5 decades. He had made a friend in prison, a man by the name of Keith Chandler, who was in prison for murder. Keith had become a jailhouse lawyer, very, very skilled in the law, and Cash had come to Keith asking for help with the parole board because every time Cash came up for parole, they would demand that he admitted to this killing and he would refuse to admit it and they would deny him parole. And so Cash was asking Keith for advice. And he said to Keith, "I'm innocent." And then he kind of held up his hands and said, "I'm not expecting you to do anything about that. I'm just hoping you can help me with parole." Keith never forgot Cash and always believed him. And when he got out, he started working for an attorney and advised that attorney to take one of these parole cases, which didn't end up working out. But the attorney was listed on the internet as Cash's lawyer. And I told you, no one ever forgets Cash's name, including the older sister of one of the eyewitnesses in the case. And all these years later, she just typed Cash's name into a search engine. And she was horrified to realize that he was still incarcerated. And then she tried to find out everything she could. She saw that he had a lawyer. She called the office and was able to speak to Keith. And when Keith heard her name, knowing everything that he knew about the case, he knew that this could be a tremendous breakthrough. And then he started reinvestigating it.
Where do you come in?
So Keith, he's an ex-convict. He was convicted of a murder, not a lawyer. He went to every lawyer that he knew of to ask the lawyers to take this case because Keith dug and dug, and he got to the eyewitnesses, and he was able to get all kinds of evidence that showed that this trial was really problematic. But in the end of the day, no one would take the case, and no one really believed in it. And finally, Keith felt that he had no choice but to file it on his own for Cash. So he filed it pro se. And most of these petitions just get tossed in the recycling because tons of people say they're innocent when they're not. It came before a judge named Catherine Mader in Los Angeles, and Keith's writing and his explanations and the evidence that he brought forward was really compelling to her. And she decided that Cash needed a lawyer. And so she appointed us. And that's how the Innocence Project came to be attached to the case.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Cash was ultimately exonerated, Judge Mader asked Keith to stand. He was in the courtroom. And she said, "I just want to acknowledge the remarkable work of Keith Chandler and what he did. And that's really the reason why we're here." And Keith actually has gone on to go to law school and pass the bar.
So at what point does restorative justice for Cash and for others, when does that enter the picture?
It doesn't really enter the picture until after the exoneration. I think a lot of people who are locked up for years go through an internal process that helps them enter into restorative justice with an open mind and an open spirit, which is that they go through a series of psychological twists and turns where they really get to the point where they feel like they forgive the person and the people who wrongfully accused and even wrongfully prosecuted them. So I think a lot of people are able to do that work. But that said, oftentimes it can take months or years for folks post-exoneration to really want to engage in this work because it's very, very hard. And you have to relive the trauma and you have to basically go back to the wreckage of a crash site and work through what happened in these twisted pieces of metal and make a new object together with the people on the other side. And that's something that for a lot of people, it takes a very long time for them to want to get to that place.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, again, back to Janet Burke's story, about how the restorative justice evolved. He spent a long time in prison, and she took a while to become part of the process.
Their case was interesting because when Janet was told that she had made a mistake and that Thomas had spent 26 years in prison and the real rapist was a man named Leon Davis Jr., she just went into a vortex of shame and depression and real fear. I think she was terrified that Thomas would be so angry with her, he would come after her or come after her family. She then went into this mode of information gathering, and she formed this relationship with Thomas's attorney, Sean, where Sean explained to Janet how it was that she had made this mistake. It wasn't that she was racist or a bad person, all the things that Janet had been telling herself. And Sean explained about the perils of cross-racial identification, the things you and I have been talking about. And then Janet became an advocate for Thomas in the media. She was allowed to remain anonymous as a sexual assault victim. She gave numerous interviews where she said that she had made a mistake and that she believed he was innocent of some other crimes for which he had also been convicted, based again on other women making mistakes. So she had gone through a little bit of that process. But when Thomas got out, he had to rebuild his whole life, and it was a big struggle for him for a long time. And it was a real struggle for Janet, too, just to grapple with all of her feelings. And so they didn't actually meet each other face-to-face for about 3 years. The impetus for that was this woman who is really kind of the impetus or the spark behind making this kind of restorative justice a national project, Jennifer Thompson, who also wrongfully identified someone who had attacked her and formed a relationship with him and wrote this best-selling book called Picking Cotton. Janet had read that book, and Jennifer was getting an award. And Sean approached Janet and asked whether she would be willing to give the award to Jennifer with Thomas, which, of course, would require them meeting beforehand. And Sean asked the same thing of Thomas, and they agreed to have this meeting.
Well, you explained to us why Thomas came across as someone as innocent. So from a jailhouse lawyer all the way up through the Innocence Project, how does one go about determining whether you're looking at someone who's genuinely innocent?
It's really difficult. I mean, the thing that was interesting about Thomas's case is that he seemed to convince these kind of hardened, seasoned prosecutors that he was innocent very quickly. And that is surprising. So he had to convince three different prosecutors because the rest of the story is that he wasn't just convicted of raping Janet. He was convicted of sexually assaulting two other women, one in Richmond and one in a neighboring county. So those convictions, because they had no DNA associated with them, had to be overturned through this extraordinarily difficult process. And to have that happen, these prosecutors had to get on board. And they did. Really quickly after meeting him, they felt convinced by the way he carried himself, by his composure, by the way he answered their questions. I believe he took a lie detector test, that he was absolutely telling the truth. He just came across as someone who was completely sincere. But I think that is unusual. And a lot of times, exonerees really have to fight to get people to believe that they're innocent because, as you say, plenty of people will say that they're innocent if they think that that's going to help them. And I will say that as the director of the Innocence Project at Loyola, we did look into a number of cases where people said they were innocent and it turned out that they were guilty. So sometimes you have to really spend time and resources looking into a case and then realize, okay, the truth is not what this person is telling me.
Yeah, at every step along the way, you're counting on someone, the first person to hear the story, and then the lawyers who review the story, and whether the prosecutor is willing to take a fresh look at this story. And they cross all kinds of lines. You see conservatives, you see liberals, you see Republicans, you see Democrats who willingly get involved. And I have to say, I fell over and died when I saw Ken Cuccinelli painted in not just a favorable light, but in fact, a very favorable light, really went to bat for someone. Tell us how he got involved here, because this is truly impressive.
Ken Cuccinelli II, or as he is affectionately called, the Cooch, was the attorney general for the state of Virginia when this DNA evidence came to light. And as I said, the problem was that Thomas, of course, could have been freed in Janet's case, but he was still doing what amounted to life sentences in these other two cases, and there was no DNA evidence. So these two prosecutors that I mentioned in those two cases went to the Cooch, and they were not optimistic for the reasons that you said. He ran on a law and order platform, and he's very, very conservative. He heard them out, and then he went and looked at all of the cases, and he told me that he's a left brain guy. He's really about the data. So he looked at all of the cases for which Leon Davis Jr., Janet's rapist, had been convicted, and it was over a dozen. And he made charts, and he put them up against the wall, and he looked at the five cases where Thomas had been accused, and he put those up against the wall. And he saw just a modus operandi down to the words that the rapist used, down to the places that he picked, down to the weapon, and he just became absolutely convinced. And then he saw the two pictures of Thomas Haynesworth and Leon Davis Jr.'s mugshot side by side, which, of course, none of the victims had ever seen because Leon Davis wasn't in the arrays that they were shown. And he felt that they looked so similar that it made perfect sense to him that this had been a mistake and a horrible miscarriage of justice. And the thing about Ken Cuccinelli is that he's an absolutist. So when he believes something, he believes it, and you cannot convince him to the contrary. So once he became convinced that Thomas Haynesworth was innocent, he believed that he had a moral obligation to do everything he could to get him out of prison.
Mm-hmm. What did his involvement mean for the case?
It meant everything. So he did a number of things that were quite remarkable, particularly in the context of what many prosecutors do, as we talked about, which is simply deny that the person is innocent. I mean, the easy path for Ken Cuccinelli would have been to say, we have these two convictions, 12 people convicted in case one, 12 people convicted in case two. The two victims are not taking back their identifications. These convictions are final. I'm standing by them. He didn't do that. Instead, he went to the governor and said, you need to parole him as soon as possible. When Thomas got out on parole, he was a convicted sex offender. Ken Cuccinelli's next move was to say to Thomas, I want to apologize to you on behalf of the state for what we did to you. Very emotional apology. And then he offered him a job in the attorney general's office. So Thomas, a convicted sex offender, went to work in the office of the prosecutor who was purportedly there to uphold his conviction. And there was a lot of pushback in the attorney general's office about that decision. And once again, Ken Cuccinelli shrugged it off because his feeling was, if I truly believe this person is innocent, why wouldn't I try to do everything I could to make his life better, including offering him a job? Once Thomas was employed, the Cooch went to work undoing the conviction, which meant siding with Thomas's lawyers, which is highly unusual. So the case is called Commonwealth versus Haynesworth, and the V is supposed to separate the sides. What Cuccinelli did was adopt the arguments that Thomas Haynesworth's lawyers were making, and he made them as well. And so essentially, when he stood up to argue in the Court of Appeal, he was making the same arguments that the innocence attorneys were making.
How exceptional is that?
Extremely exceptional. And what I also thought was really interesting about the argument was that it was a full panel of judges. Usually it's just three, but all of them wanted to rehear this case, so there were nine of them. And some of them gave him a really hard time and said, how can you possibly say that you want us to undo this conviction? Your job is to uphold convictions. And he said, no, my job is to do justice, and this is a wrongful conviction, and I'm not going to stand here and defend it. He showed, I think, a tremendous amount of courage, a kind of courage that a lot of prosecutors don't show. He had a lot of insight into the harm that was done that a lot of prosecutors don't have. And he really went above and beyond and took a lot of risks to make things right. I've never actually seen a case play out that way.
And there are prosecutors, attorneys general, who just won't let go and will go through multiple court appearances to make it stick when it's clear to anyone with a brain this was wrong.
Yes. In my hometown of Philadelphia, that exact thing happened in this case involving a man named Anthony Wright. He was convicted of raping and murdering an elderly woman named Louise Talley, and he was sent to prison for 25 years. His attorneys had to fight with the district attorney for 5 years, even to get DNA testing, because the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office's position was that Tony Wright was not entitled to it, because he had signed a statement admitting to his guilt, which was extracted from him by Philadelphia police officers who threatened him with serious physical violence. So after all of that happened and the DNA test results came back, they matched another man named Ronnie Byrd. And the reaction of the DA was to agree to a new trial and then try Tony Wright again under a completely different theory. So in 1993, they told the jury that he had acted alone and raped and murdered this elderly woman. In 2016, they went back and told another 12 people that no, he and Ronnie Byrd, who had no known connection to each other, had joined up to commit this crime together, and that Ronnie Byrd had been the rapist and that Tony Wright had repeatedly stabbed and killed Louise Talley. The jurors were back in the deliberation room for 5 minutes. And when they came back, they acquitted him of everything. And the four women said, "I am angry. The state never should have brought this case."
Wow. Well, we've talked about dealing with the psychology. We've talked about the opportunity event for people to be together. We haven't really talked a great extent about the cash that may make up some kind of judgment against the state or some kind of gift from the state to say, take this out. We're sorry for the injustice. Go make a better life. And you mentioned that that's not available in all states. So it's a matter of law as to where that's available?
Yes. So it's a crazy patchwork. For example, if you are wrongfully convicted in Texas and you get out, you are entitled to $80,000 a year for every year that you were wrongfully convicted. You also get an annuity and you get some degree of free college tuition or credits. If you are exonerated in the state of Pennsylvania, you get nothing. Zero. And it's simply because the Texas legislature has decided to compensate people who've been wrongfully convicted, and the Pennsylvania legislature has refused to do that. So there are a number of states, I think it's somewhere around 20, where there is just no compensation. And then there are other states that cap the compensation at a ridiculously low amount, $25,000, no matter how many years you did. Or even in Oklahoma, they cap it at $175,000. That's not a lot of money if you've done 20 years. Mm-hmm. So for many of these exonerees, the only way for them to get compensated is if they sue. And they can sue the police department, they can sue the county. Prosecutors almost always have absolute immunity, so it's very difficult to sue them. But the police don't. And in cases of really egregious misconduct, exonerees can win large judgments. But again, that's very dependent on who their lawyers are, the strength of the case, the egregiousness of the misconduct, all kinds of things that are just very variable.
I don't know if it's possible to quantify this, but is there any evidence that having to pay out these judgments makes any difference in how police procedure goes on and what gets prosecuted subsequently? Does there appear to be a lesson attached to this?
I wish I could say that there was, but I don't think so. And I'll give you an example. In my client's case, he got the largest judgment that the county of Los Angeles ever had to pay out, which was almost $19 million. Because he had done so much time. He had done 34 years. And I don't see any difference in the way that the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office prosecutes cases. I don't see any difference in the way the Los Angeles Police Department goes after and investigates suspects. So you're looking at a judgment that's huge, and it's not the only one that LA County has paid out by any means. Mm-hmm. And yet I can't point to a change in policy or procedure that seems meaningful.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the effort that you make putting a book together like this, the effort that the Innocence Project makes trying to, you know, get this fixed. What that is up against in terms of what the public knows about the judicial system and how much the public cares. It just strikes me that we as the general public don't have a lot of opportunities to hear about how it works and why people are unjustly convicted and what it takes to get out of it and all those wasted lives. I'm just wondering what you think is the public perception now and how that might be improved.
I do think that the public perception and understanding and appreciation of wrongful convictions and also the role of official misconduct has radically transformed in the last, I would say, 10 or 15 years, and particularly maybe in the last 5 years with the advent of podcasts like Serial and documentaries like Making a Murderer. And it has just opened people's eyes to the failings of the system because the public loves true crime stories. I think we've always gravitated to those stories. And when those stories are also about a wrongful conviction, it's really eye-opening and it educates people. So I actually believe that because of stories like that, the public is much, much more aware of the fallibilities of the system and more willing to believe that, for example, people can commit misconduct or that someone could confess, but it could be false.
Right.
Whereas we used to think there's no way that you could go to court and point at someone and say you were 100% sure and be wrong. if you confess to something, you must be guilty. I mean, those are things that I think most people took for granted. And now I don't think that's true.
Did you hear, and this goes years back, it was a This American Life episode. One boy was literally convinced over the course of the interrogation that he was, in fact, responsible for a murder. I think it's one of the most striking pieces of audio tape I have ever heard, to hear his cries as he was slowly convinced that he actually committed a murder. That kind of thing has a massive impact.
It does. And there was an amazing piece in The New Yorker maybe 6 or 8 months ago about the same thing, where the police were able to convince a group of people that they had carried out a murder and none of them had done it. It's really startling, the kind of coercion that interrogation can exert on someone, that you can literally be convinced that you did this horrible thing that you didn't do. It's very dramatic when you hear the audio tape and you can kind of peer behind the curtain and see what's going on. Because if you couldn't actually hear those audio tapes, I'm not sure you would believe it.
Right. There are cases that you have in the book, at least one case that stands out to me, where the interrogation was not recorded, and essentially the person doing the interrogation come out and essentially say anything about what just happened in there and be believed, because they are the authority figure, and whatever the person being interrogated says about what happens in there is inherently suspect. Do you see those procedures being reviewed now?
I do. So that case was truly egregious, where you had a detective come out and say this woman, Deborah Milkey, gave a full confession to orchestrating the murder of her son. And she said, I absolutely did not. I denied it throughout the interrogation. And even though he had been instructed to record it, he didn't. And he was the only one in there. And it turned out all these years later that he had a long track record of lying and cheating and doing all kinds of unbelievable things as a police officer to coerce suspects and extract false confessions and commit perjury. There is now a wave of reform around the way interrogations are conducted, in particular requiring that they be recorded. Philadelphia, for example, the Philadelphia Police Department now records all murder interrogations. And again, it's because I think they were getting into a lot of trouble for the way that they were interrogating people, mm-hmm. and what they were saying happened and what in fact happened in those rooms. And so I think more and more we're seeing that there's a demand for accountability because we have these outrageous cases.
That's Lara Bazelon. Her new book is Rectify. You can find the whole interview online. It's an hour long at indeepradio.com/podcasts. And that, my friends, is a wrap for this episode of The Bradcast. Brad and Des are back on board for the next go-round. I will be back with you over the holidays. Until then, good luck, world.